lecture has three basic sections. Part one and two provide a general and hopefully a generally available introduction. Parts three through six are a close reading, hence difficult, analysis of Hegel's text, perhaps not so widely available. And parts 7 through 10 is my attempt to see the general import of Hegel's thought. This will be followed by 5 requests. The lecture will be about an hour. I'd like to begin this evening with an aphorism. Thinking and philosophy are good. Sometimes, however, we have to think about how we think, about the kind of thinking that engages us, and the consequences of the mode of conceptualization we think so revealing. For some light is glare, some inspiration intoxicating, and some insight precipitous. Thinking and philosophy are good, but. Part one. By way of prologue, some historical observations are in order, or one might say reasons not to conflate the American and French revolutions, indeed reasons to wonder about the latter. One. History textbooks can be misleading. The American and French revolutions are often thought to be similar. However, ours was a war of liberation from foreign domination, and theirs, the French, was a civil war, displacing the existing political and social structure. Two, ours was not a revolution to establish democracy. We were already democratic. The French, by contrast, was a grand effort to plant democratic government in monarchical soil. Ours was successful, and theirs was followed by the Napoleonic Empire and decades upon decades of political instability. Three, moreover, the standard Marxist interpretations may not be adequate. Neither economic nor class conflict simply explains the extraordinary character of events. There were food shortages at the time, but in general, the revolution took place during a 50-year period of economic growth. More importantly, economies were worse in other countries where no revolution took place. Also, many liberal nobility, lawyers and civil servants and clergy were part of the early reformers. The peasants, many of whom had recently become landowners, were late in joining the movement. Marx himself called it a bourgeois revolution. Four, despite their shared admiration for ancient republics, the French revolutionaries did not learn the same lessons that the American framers did from Greek and Roman history. Most prominently, the American framers learned the need to place constitutional restraints on popular democracy. Five, King Louis XVI, an earlier supporter of the American Revolution, had already begun to undertake reforms. The revolutionaries, however, rejected gradual reform in favor of radical change. Six, most revealing, much of the early popular resentment was against the extreme centralization of authority by the king and the consequent displacement of the regional authorities. The king's intendants replaced local authorities and disinvested the nobility. The French revolutionaries, however, continued this centralization of power, though through a successive series of elections through electors. 7, the fall of the Bastille was largely symbolic. There were only 7 prisoners at the time. 8, the theorists of the French Revolution, the philosophers, wanted to be original. They rejected the English model of a constitutional monarchy and the American model of representative government and balance and division of powers. In short, they rejected Montesquieu. The guillotine, among whose victims, by the way, was Lavoisier, did not only behead aristocrats and clergy. A substantial number of those killed during the Reign of Terror weren't nobles. Most astonishing of all, many of the revolutionary leaders themselves met the same fate. But above all, why the Reign of Terror? Above all, why 20 or 40,000 people guillotined? Why such extremes? The original motto of the revolution was liberté, égalité, fraternité, ou la mort. That is liberty, equality, fraternity, or death. All these observations raise the question how we are to understand the French Revolution as a unique event by itself, different in kind and motivation from ours. Hegel offers an interpretation. There's a little section in the Phenomenology of Spirit that I'd like to call to your attention. So little, 9 out of 500+ pages, that it's quite possible that one might not even notice it. It is a transition stage, however, and thus, as in all Hegel, is essential not to be overlooked. The section is entitled Absolute Freedom and Terror, and seeks to articulate the spiritual transformation, the inner revolution, as Hegel called it, underlying the historical events that came to fruition in the French Revolution, and hence is part of our collective inheritance. But before we start, a few caveats. Speaking about Hegel is, to say the least, very difficult. For one, excerpting such a small section from out of a larger whole risks being grossly misleading. It is like looking at a small branch of a very large tree without seeing the tree, and thus without seeing the branch's integration within the whole. Moreover, despite his abstruse conceptualization and forbidding language, Hegel seeks to speak about the actual. Both cases require a large dose of generosity on our part and no small effort to see that what he is actually talking about is our world, our history, the life in which we find ourselves. It is thus quite possible that much of what follows will not be immediately intelligible. Seniors suspect what I mean. But bear with me. The way may be somewhat grim, but the end has its rewards. You may come away with questions you've not asked before. Additional preliminaries. Perhaps it goes without saying that Hegel thinks differently than we do. Ideas for Hegel are never just thought entities, never mere ideas. Ideas are real and have an objective vitality. They are, he says, forces in the world. This is what Hegel means by history. Ideas, too, can be misguided, partial, atavistic, lose their connection to the real, become empty, and take flight. This is what Hegel means by unrealized abstractions. Moreover, when he uses terms such as understanding, reason, consciousness, self-consciousness, will, etc., he is speaking of these not as psychic processes simply, but as manifestations of the much larger development of what he calls world spirit. Hegel also has the exasperating practice, especially in the phenomenology, of speaking about a stage of development in its most philosophical, that is, spiritual implications, without reference to the text or the historical event that gave expression to it. And it is generally recognized that the section Absolute Freedom and Terror addresses what Hegel calls the greatest world event of our time. The greatest world event of our, that is his, time. The French Revolution and its horrendous consequences. Unavoidably, I do presume some familiarity with the historical events and with the phenomenology. Lastly, as I work through this text, I will not say quote unquote. You will know when it's Hegel speaking. I will do my best to keep us grounded. There is also a handout to assist you through the difficult language. Hegel's specific thesis can be stated simply: the conceptual and spiritual transformation that emerges in the mid-18th century that we call the Enlightenment leads both to the French Revolution and the Reign of Terror. That is, a certain kind of thinking leads to violence. So our concern this evening will be to consider the connection between this new mode of thinking, this new idealism, if you will, and violence, and to wonder whether this mode of thinking might somehow still be with us. Part three. In this section of the phenomenology, spirit is at that early stage of enlightenment where it is still working out its, that is, our Cartesian inheritance. It is not yet fully realized, Hegel says, the foundational insight in place implicit in Descartes' thinking that being and thought are the same, but remains at the intermediate stage where the whole is rent asunder. That is, we still see ourselves over against an external world. A step toward a fuller realization of this inheritance is to think and live in a world through the concept of utility, where objects are thought of instrumentally as useful for ourselves. In this way, all things are related to us, though consciousness does not find itself in possessions of these immediately, it yet possesses them immediately as an end towards which it strives. In this way, the total objectivity of the object is withdrawn, Hegel says. The total objectivity of the object is withdrawn, in that now all is thought immediately through us. This is decisive and prepares the next metamorphosis of spirit, Hegel says. From the inner revolution, there emerges the actual revolution of the actual world, the new shape of consciousness, absolute freedom. A new shape of consciousness? Self-consciousness now grasps the fact that its certainty of itself is, in some sense, the essence of all spiritual spheres, classes, institutions, professions, social strata, etc., of the real as well as the supersensible world. In other words, the world and its social structures are not seen as simply other, as externally objective, but now seen as intimately related to us. All reality is thus spiritual, Hegel says. All reality is thus spiritual. At this moment, spirit has come to realize the world is for it, that is, for consciousness, simply its own will, and this as a general will. The world is for it simply its own will. The will of all individuals taken as such, so that each is now undivided from the whole. Previously estranged, the will now extended finds its identity in a more encompassing unification, a generalized will. With this, we undergo a major transformation and self-development. Hegel describes this new way of being in the world thus: each individual consciousness raises itself out of its allotted sphere, its class, its profession, and no longer finds its essence and its work in any particular sphere or activity, but grasps itself anew as the concept of a general will. Grasps all spheres as the essence of this new, more fully realized transpersonal will, and now can only realize itself in a work which is the work of the whole. And now can only properly realize itself in a work which is the work of the whole. As a result of this self-generalization, so to speak, all social groups or classes are effectively abolished as other. The individual self-consciousness that heretofore belonged to any such particular spheres and willed and it fulfilled itself therein has now put aside its previously self-defining limitation, namely its particularity, its identity. The result? Consciousness's purpose has now become the general purpose. Its language now becomes universal law, its work, universal work. The result of this transition, we have, so to speak, become generalized. We have become universal consciousness. Let's think about this transition. The traditional person with his or her particular experience is, Hegel says, put aside. The new individual consciousness is no less directly conscious of itself as universal will. It now becomes aware of its proper object as a general law, given by that general will and a work accomplished by it, that is, spirit as general will. With the result that in passing over into action and in creating objectivity, individual consciousness is doing nothing individual. Individual consciousness is doing nothing individual, but carrying out the general laws and functions of the state. We hereby acknowledge our agency as an expression of a more general will. Conscious of itself as universal will, doing nothing individual, identifying with, literally finding one's identity in, the political whole, the state, individual personhood is thus supplanted by universal consciousness. Simply put, Fred or Frida Jones, or at St. John's, Mr. or Miss Jones, has now become Citizen Jones, and subsequently World Citizen Jones. Whereas before we might have been concerned with saving our soul, now we are concerned with saving our nation or humankind, and perhaps subsequently saving the planet. Our proper work is now thought alone to be universal work. To express this in the clearest way, Hegel says, universal freedom would thereby be free from particular individuality. When we think thus abstractly, we are no longer our old selves. We are free from human particularity. We take up the cause of the universal will, and hence we are no one in particular. We have become abstract entities and live on an even higher plane of universality. This ascent to universal consciousness, according to Hegel, is the distinctive import of the Enlightenment and modern freedom. But there are problems with this yet underdeveloped notion of universal consciousness. Part 4. Consider this curiosity. While we might think in universal terms, we can only act in particular ways. And this, Hegel says, undermines our general spiritual aspirations. Before the universal as agent can perform any particular deed, he says, spirit must first concentrate or locate itself in the one of individuality, that is, in an actual individual self-consciousness. For the universal will is only actual will in a self as agent. The universal will is only actual will in a self. One individually takes upon oneself the universal intention, thus isolating the locus of agency. In so doing, in being embedded in one actor, Hegel says, all other individuals are, as such, excluded from the entirety of its deed, so that the deed would not be a deed of some actual universal self-consciousness per se. Spirit does not act on its own here. It acts through individuals. Yet in so doing, one is no longer undivided from the whole, and the general will is fractured. The implications of this rupture are quite disturbing, according to Hegel. Universal freedom as such, therefore, can produce neither a positive work nor a deed, because they are always both specific. There is left for it as universal only negative action. Universal freedom is therefore merely the fury of destruction, or perhaps more precise translation, the fury of disappearing. Merely the fury of destruction. Here the universal does not act as such, but through a universalized individual. Any positive action that it may consider, however, is always specific and hence not simply universal. Thus, the only pure universality available to it is negative action. The only action available to it is to remove or destroy the conditions of particular action. For this reason, Hegel says, universal freedom is merely the fury of destruction. In short, while we may aspire to universality, we cannot reach beyond particularity except to destroy it. This fracture is then spelled out further. Spirit now divides itself into two defective extremes, equally abstract, in this case a bad word for Hegel. On the one hand, he says, it divides itself into a simple, inflexible, cold universality. On the other, into the discrete, absolute hard reality and self-will atomism of actual self-consciousnesses. Having effectively completed the total revolutionary destruction of the actual organization of the world, think about that. Having completed the total revolutionary destruction of the actual organization of the world, and here Hegel is not being hyperbolic, but has in mind as an example the destruction of the monarchy, nobility, and clergy in France at the onset of the revolution, such an abstract consciousness exists now just for itself. That is, it is itself its sole object, an object that no longer has any specific content, possession, existence, or outer extension to give it any definition. This abstractified individual, if that's a word, Hegel says is merely this knowledge of itself as an absolutely pure and free individual self. All that remains is its existence as such, a mere contentless, predicateless being there. Thus, having obliterated the world of particulars, it finds it has nothing left but its own abstracted being for self in the most extreme forms of cold universality or simple self-willed atomism. Modern freedom, according to Hegel, thus takes two forms: ideology, or humanly indifferent cold universality, and sheer willfulness, or arbitrary indiscriminate will. Part 5. One might think this picture extreme. But how else to explain, Hegel wonders, how a revolution inspired by the highest human ideals, by liberty, equality, and fraternity, and by the rights of man and citizen, inspired, one might have thought, by the love of country and humanity, could yet have led to the most dreadful human consequences. Hegel's conclusion, the relationship between the revolution and its so-called aftermath is not contingent, is not accidental. It is rather the necessary outcome of the transformation of thought at this stage of reason. He thus concludes that the sole work and deed of this new mode of consciousness, universal abstract freedom, is death. Whoa! The work of universal freedom is death. Let us listen to the whole passage. The sole defining work and deed of universal freedom is therefore death. A death which has no inner significance, for what is negated is nothing but the empty point of the absolutely free self. It is thus the coldest and meanest of all deaths, with no more significance than that of cutting off a head of cabbage or swallowing a mouthful of water. The sole work of universal freedom is death. Again, how can an ideal such as freedom, our cherished liberal ideal, find its expression or instantiation in what appears to be its opposite, in pure negation, in the elimination of the actual, in death? And not just death, but a death without inner significance. We have come to that stage where what is negated is nothing but the empty point of the absolutely free self. And as we know at St. John's, a point is that which has no part and is thus, in some sense, no thing. What is negated, then, is no longer a person, commonly understood, with character, loved ones, family history, ethnicity, nationality, individual accomplishments, and a smile. But on this rarefied level of consciousness, an abstraction, an empty point with no inner significance, a free self, in short, humanity dehumanized. The image Hegel calls to mind is unsettling. The mass elimination of such point cells is to be compared to the routine, banal, matter-of-fact cutting off the heads of cabbages for the soup of the day. His image of the work of the guillotine. But how have we gotten to the place where people have no more significance than cabbages? Our thinking changed. We changed. What is perhaps even more surprising about this account is that the mass extermination that follows is not the result of passion. No rampaging barbarian hordes besetting unsuspecting villages. This results rather from the very progress of spirit, from the progress of reason itself. We here encounter one of those moments in the history of spirit where the significance of an individual human being is eclipsed, erased, indeed annihilated, and this because of the imperfect strivings of reason. Thus, the human search for meaning has led to a stage of human meaninglessness. What may have been thought to have had absolute worth worthy of salvation, a human soul, for example, now no longer has inherent dignity. And this because thought, not passion, has yet to mature, such that we take a life as we would take a sip of water. With these images, Hegel seeks to capture the frightful transcendental impersonality of it all, an indifferent, willful, cold steel blade. His paradoxical thesis, the reign of terror is the result of the progress of reason. The reign of terror is the result of the Enlightenment. part six. In addition, this stage of consciousness contains a harsh truth for governance. Hegel says, in this flat, commonplace monosyllable, that is tot or death, is contained the new wisdom of the government, wherein the abstract intelligence of the universal will seeks to fulfill itself. The government now becomes nothing else but the displaced, self-established focus of the newly transferred individuality of the universal will. Having itself lost its content, the individual self-identifies with the larger whole, the government or abstract state. Having sought to free itself from the repressive universal, the monarchy, it now finds its identity in a new self, the displaced universality, the abstract state. Add to this another cruel irony. Such a notion of government as itself the embodiment of the universal could only be misleadingly inclusive, Hegel observes, misleadingly universal, for it excludes other individuals from its act. In so doing, the revolutionary government itself ends up being despotic, opposed to the universal will. Again, one can think universally, but one can only act particularly. Consequently, it is absolutely impossible, Hegel says, for it, the new revolutionary government, to exhibit itself, that is, to look as if it were anything else but another political faction. And in so doing, it becomes, in turn, the victim of the very logic that brought it into being. In the very fact of its being yet another faction, Hegel says, lies the direct necessity in turn of its own overthrow, as it is now but another crime against the universal. In short, what we took to be the actual universal is only an unrealized pure will, and hence a mere or unrealized intention. As such, such abstract revolutions are by nature and by Hegelian logic unstable. The road to this hell, the French Revolution, it would appear, is paved with unrealized abstract universals. Moreover, this leads in turn to a serious disharmony between the unrealized universal, the state, and those who had hoped to find their fulfillment therein, the people. The result, according to Hegel and history, infinite suspicion. Being suspect now takes the place or has the significance and effect of being guilty. Inasmuch as the inner intent of a person cannot be discerned, any hint of reluctance appears seditious and guilty. The logic of such revolutionary consciousness runs thus. If you are not with us, you are against us. And we don't know if you're with us. The external reaction against this reality lies in the simple, unavailable inwardness of intention that one cannot penetrate, and thus leads to the necessary, cold, matter-of-fact annihilation of this existent actual self, a self, now a mere self, from which nothing can be taken away but its mere being. For it has become an empty point, a mere being there. Thus, the impersonality and indifference of this new universal state to its own so-called citizens, empty points, monads, conspirators, victims, in short, terror reigns. The logic of revolutionary consciousness has reduced the human being to a mere being, a cabbage. The sense of otherness and insignificance predominates and leads to suspicion and a sense of expendableness. From the side of the citizen, terror, from the side of the state, accusation, summary execution, the cold steel blade. And this, its characteristic work, namely death, Hegel says, absolute freedom becomes explicitly objective to itself, And self-consciousness learns, to its horror, we hope, what absolute freedom in effect truly is. In itself, absolute freedom is just this absolute self-consciousness, which effaces, that is, annihilates, all distinction and all continuation or perpetuation of distinction within itself. It is as such in this way that it is objective to itself. The terror of death is the new vision of this negative nature to itself. Absolute freedom effaces all distinctions. Abstract freedom is but blind willfulness. Existence is but a lived or felt negation. Terror of death is its face. Of equal significance is one further implication not to be overlooked. The universal will, here heightened, he says, to the level of pure thought or abstract matter, changes round into its negative and shows itself on the other side to be equally that which puts an end also to the thinking of oneself or to self-consciousness. Puts an end to the thinking of oneself or to self-consciousness. From the side of the point self, the universal will obliterates not only all distinctions apart from itself, but now also all distinctions within itself. So extreme is the logic of reason here, so radical, so absolute, so pure, that it in effect puts an end even to its own self-consciousness. This leads to a self-obliterating, unarticulated, empty oneness, a homogeneity of nothing in particular. The revolution is now total, the obliteration not just external, but internal as well. This is the other side of the spiritual revolution, humanity dehumanized. Thinking and philosophy are good, but, part seven. But human beings, even such abstract human beings such as we have become, Hegel now acknowledges can't live like this. If we cannot be at home in the revolutionary abstract state, nor at home in our alienated, reduced point cells, then where are we to find our home? These individuals who have felt the fear of death their absolute master, Hegel says, once again submit to negation and distinction, rearrange themselves in the various social and political spheres, return to an apportioned and limited task, and thereby return to their substantial reality. Our conceptual aspirations had distorted our human reality. The truth is that we cannot live as unrealized abstract universals. We thus retreat from the abstract and deadly universal and find our substantial reality once again in an apportioned and limited task. Through the fear of death, we now revert to who we once were and recommit ourselves to a particular world. This return to a particular world, however, might look like a major step backwards in the progress of spirit. Might look like an inauthentic retreat to convention, tradition, and culture, in short, to particularity. Out of this tumult, Hegel says, spirit would seem to be thrown back to its original starting point, to the earlier ethical and real world of Greek culture, which would seem to have been merely refreshed and rejuvenated by the fear of the Lord and Master, death, which has again entered men's hearts. With the result that it would seem that spirit would have to traverse anew and continually repeat this cycle of necessity. One step forward, two steps back. Are we starting over again? And if we are continually thrown back to the beginning, is there no real progress of spirit? Hegel's response to the prospect of continual repetition of return, and thus to the possible illusion of progress, is that the race course of spirit, the circuit of necessity, is not closed, at least not at this point. And he adds, this would be so only if the result were only the complete re-interpenetration of self-consciousness and substance. That is, such return is premature. It may temporarily resolve our alienation, subject and object dichotomy, but it would not bring about our true fulfillment. Part 8. It is true, Hegel continues, that at this stage in the world of culture itself, consciousness does not get as far as to behold its negation or alienation in the form of pure abstraction. That is, it hasn't yet become explicit to itself. On the contrary, its negation, its emptiness, is now filled with transitional content. It invests itself either in honor or wealth, which it gains in place of the self which had it alienated from itself, or the imperfect language of spirit, which the disrupted consciousness acquires, or the heaven of faith, or the earlier utility of enlightenment. In place of the self that it has alienated itself, in place of the self that it has alienated from itself, consciousness now, unself-consciously, that is, unknowingly finds refuge in the time-tested, ready-to-hand, though now unfulfilling forms of being, honor, money, religion, utility, the language of spirit which the disrupted consciousness acquires, etc. These serve as way stations, so to speak, until it grows into its next shape. As such, they prove to be no true refuge. The deeper reality for such an intermediate disrupted consciousness remains, however, for Hegel, still negative. All these prior determinations have vanished in the loss suffered by the self in absolute freedom. The loss suffered by the self in absolute freedom. That is, despite its temporary refuge, its reality remains. The death that is without meaning, or a sense of radical contingency or finitude, the terror of the negative, or angst, and that nothing fills it with true content, or anomie, estrangement, inauthenticity. Old forms no longer serve, and yet there is no going back. Despite this sense of loss that the present actuality is not yet our fullest possibility, Hegel makes the remarkable and characteristic claim here that consciousness is still not at a total loss, but somehow yet knows that universal will to be itself, and thus knows itself to be more than its imperfect stage, rather knows itself to be essential being. The result, then, is not wholly negative. There is a determinate negation to be realized here. Its realization is two-sided. While spirit somehow knows that it is universal will, it has here learned specifically that it is not to be found in will as revolutionary government, nor as anarchy striving to establish anarchy, nor itself as the center of faction. In short, it has learned that its fulfillment is not to be found in revolution, nor anarchy, nor political absolutism. Thus, despite consciousness's failure in the foregoing, in fact, despite its falling short in each of the many several stages, it somehow yet knows that its destiny lies elsewhere. With this, Hegel says, absolute freedom has thus thereby in principle removed the antithesis between the universal and the individual will. That is, the individual has realized that it has become and is somehow universal. And so does absolute freedom now leave behind its self-destroying revolutionary reality and pass over into another land of self-conscious spirit. As an acorn knows that it is an oak tree, so spirit knows that it is more than its present state of incomplete development. Absolute freedom leaves its self-destroying reality and passes over into another land of spirit. Spirit is thus saved from tragedy or a history of perpetual disappointment. Spirit was only momentarily in retrograde then, though at this stage it may be difficult for us to see how it might yet get beyond its embedded predicament. Spirit always works behind our backs. It finds its way purified of its hyper-generalized destructive political ambitions to a higher transcendence and consolation in a new stage of universality that Hegel calls moral spirit. Thus, the prospect of a happy ending is not extinguished. Spirit and Hegel's project lives on. There's, you know, several hundred more pages. Part 9. But before we rush off with Hegel and find a happy ending in absolute knowing, let us pause for a moment and consider a curious formulation in an earlier passage. In retrograde, we saw spirit found way stations and returned to, among others, the language of spirit which the disrupted consciousness acquires. Disrupted consciousness. Along the way, it would appear there remains available to human beings intermediate, unfinished, orphaned, or remnant modes of consciousness that we've not simply outgrown. In short, we carry with us the modes of thought and conceptual baggage of unresolved prior stages of consciousness. If then, some of us never get quite clear of these imperfect stages of disrupted consciousness, namely most of us, these two need to be the focus of our inquiry. A progressive logic of spirit that keeps its philosophical eye principally on the end would be one-sided and would need to be complemented by what I call a philosophical pathology, if you will, one that looks not only at the end, but examines as well the unfulfilled stages of consciousness in all their revealing partiality. Such a diagnostic logic looks to understand the residual reality and the real and persistent consequences of imperfect knowing. Hegel, for example, asks us to consider here such an intermediate stage, the spiritual transformation that led to the brutal episode of the terror, one of many such unhappy chapters on spirit's way. As we saw, by transcending the limits of the personal in its ascent to greater universality, spirit placed the world of the individual human, our world, at the risk of the cold steel blade. He thereby shows us the need to think better about such transformations, in particular, that of abstract intelligence and our possible inheritance therefrom. Thus, should we have a Socratic moment when we realize we may not as yet have reached absolute knowing, but are ourselves somewhere in between, then what might be even more important for us to ask is where we are situated in the midst of all this world historical change. In such a circumstance, the phenomenology of spirit, now read also as a philosophical pathology, might allow us to diagnose the various stages of disrupted consciousness and their very real consequences. Part 10. Finally, in the introduction of the phenomenology of spirit, Hegel says that the dialectic of spirit is a highway of despair. A highway of despair. A dialectic he describes elsewhere as one which unsettles all particular judgments and opinions, transmuting evil into good and good into evil. But even if, in the end, absolute knowing somehow can be thought to justify all intermediary stages, let us not overlook the means thereto. What then are we to conclude about this chapter, a tale of an inner spiritual revolution, terrible and terrifying? We began by being struck by Hegel's claim that an inner philosophical or spiritual revolution precedes and underlies the outer events of the French Revolution, and that it was the unperfected stage of reason that gave birth to it and its offspring, the Reign of Terror. We followed his development from the intermediary concept of utility to spirit's next expression as absolute freedom. Reason gets an inkling that the world here, that the world is for it simply its own will, and finds itself by means of the enabling concept of the general will once again undivided from the whole. Therein its truer fulfillment. It now realizes itself in the work of the whole, where it puts aside its individuality for the sake of living universally. Freedom here meant freedom from particular individuality. But it is then that spirit encountered the paradoxical fact. Spirit here acts through individuals. As such, universal freedom had no finite way to express itself except negatively. Freedom came to mean the nihilistic removal of all the conditions of human particularity, or as Hegel says, the fury of destruction. In the process of eliminating all particularity, human being itself is reduced to mere being. It no longer has any content, possession, existence, or outer extension. Human being had become an empty, contentless point. Less than a cabbage, actually. Human being had been dehumanized. Abstract or absolute freedom here takes one of two defective forms, either ideology or willfulness, either humanly indifferent, cold universality, or arbitrary, selfless self-assertion. Hegel formulated this troubling outcome thus: the sole defining work of universal freedom is death. The consequence of the prior spiritual transformation of our thinking, in short, was so profound that we could no longer distinguish between the bloody and murderous activity of the guillotine and the routine daily activity of lopping off the head of a cabbage to make soup. This conceptual blindness and indiscriminateness was possible not because of some passion, but because of the imperfect progress of spirit, the Reign of Terror, its dreadful expression. Freedom here came to mean the unrestraint and indiscriminateness of abstract intelligence, unable to distinguish between taking a life and taking a sip of water. With this inner revolution, the new wisdom of the universal government came face to face with this fact. In having to act in specific ways, the revolutionary government appears to be yet another faction, and hence at odds with the general will. And unable to discern the true allegiance of its citizen, it came to look on them with cold, matter-of-fact suspicion. All particularity is viewed as a threat, and it undertakes the general effacement of all distinctions. The terror of death is here the new face of freedom. But spirit cannot continue thus. It must seek its substantial reality somewhere, a way station, if not its final home. In place of the self that it had alienated from itself, spirit finds an apportioned and limited task once again in the realm of the particular. It realizes that absolute freedom was a self-destroying reality, and thus that revolution, anarchy, and or political absolutism are not where its true fulfillment is to be found. A new land of consciousness awaits. Freedom there in the land of morality will seek to shake off its destructive meaning. At this point, we would all like to think that such a dark period of our Western spiritual history is simply past, that we've somehow gotten beyond it, and that we are the better for having outlived and learned about such terrifying events. Perhaps the historical events are past, but Hegel's account makes us wonder whether the philosophical change in the structure of our thinking given expression there, whether it too has been transcended, or is there a vestige of that transformation, a disrupted consciousness that yet shapes our thinking today. And so the Enlightenment, that is modern reason, in part failed, Hegel tells us, both for the history that it left behind and the legacy it bequeathed us. Indeed, it brought us in spirit to the point of self-destruction. Freedom showed itself to be multiform, striving for ever greater perfection at the risk, however, of the cold steel blade. Reason had ascended to such a level of universality that it became abstract intelligence, to the point of losing any rootedness in the actual, the particulars of our lived experience, and to personhood, the self-identity to which we once subscribed. Humanity had become dehumanized. Spirit and philosophy then have to think more about their presuppositions, their modern principles, how being and thought are to be considered the same, and whether truth is such an abstract universal, lest the rarefied plane of their generality make our lives unintelligible and expendable, and we become citizens of a world, but of no place in particular. Spirit and philosophy, then, have their work cut out for them. Five requests. So we ask you tonight to reflect on our modern inheritance from the French Revolution, how our highest ideals could possibly turn into their opposites, how liberty, equality, and fraternity could become forced homogeneity and terror. How liberty, equality, and fraternity could become license, forced homogeneity, and terror. In short, we ask you to think better about the risks of abstract intelligence. And we ask you tonight as well to consider Hegel's claim that certain forms of reason, indeed the very progress of reason, and this stage of enlightenment lead to nihilism and terror. And we ask you tonight as well to think hard about Hegel's distinction, implicit in the foregoing, that a revolution without a reformation can only end in blood and suffering, and to wonder whether and how one can wash one's hands clean with blood. And we ask you tonight to wonder how the personal became so impersonal, how human being could be dehumanized, reduced to mere being there, and to wonder whether there's still a chance that dignity and worth might yet be restored. Lastly, we ask you to consider the hypergenerality of language and thought that we find all around us, and to wonder whether such conceptual overreach might not be our legacy from the Enlightenment, and how it might be offset by a more considered review of human being. Thinking and philosophy are good, but thank you.